Disc 26.
He was prowling the big chamber now, ranging restlessly up and down, side to side. He rarely listened to the debate, except occasionally for a moment or two to see if the speaker was saying anything he hadn't anticipated. Rather, his eyes would be constantly roaming the chamber, seeing how things were going, seeing if they were going, as one aide put it. What was going on in the Republican cloakroom? How could he find out? What could he read in the faces of the senators coming out of that cloakroom? Where were his senators? Why weren't they all here? Raising his hand over his head, he would beckon Bobby Baker or one of Baker's aides, or, if they didn't see him, snap his fingers loudly to get their attention and order them to see that the senators were on their way. Were two or three on whom he had counted likely to be absent? He'd hurry across the floor to arrange live pairs. Was something going wrong? Was the chairman of Public Works drunk again, confused and rambling as he tried to manage one of his committee's bills? Striding across the floor to another senator, he would whisper, "You ready to do 5 or 10 minutes on defense? I want to get Denny off the floor." Then, forcing himself to move slowly so as not to attract attention, he'd walk down the aisle to where Chavez was standing, take his arm, if that wasn't enough, take his lapel and put his other arm around his shoulder, whisper, "Denny, I'd like to talk to you outside for a minute," raise a hand for recognition, tell the presiding officer, "Mr. President, I'd like to suspend discussion, and if it be the will of the Senate, take up the Defense Appropriations Bill, and we will bring Public Works back in a few minutes," and then lead Chavez up the aisle and out the door. Did he catch a glimpse, as the doors to the Republican cloakroom swung open, of a GOP senator on whose vote he was counting, talking inside the cloakroom in a suspiciously cordial manner to a White House liaison man? Waiting until the senator came out on the floor, he would check to see if the vote was still firm, and if it wasn't, he'd be moving quickly to some other senator to try to replace it. With the vote all but upon him now, he seemed always to be in motion, and the motion would be faster, almost frenzied. As he talked to senators, his hands never stopped moving, gesturing expressively, chopping the air with that snake-killing gesture, opening a palm to illustrate a point, punching the air with a fist, jabbing a lapel with a finger, patting a senator's shoulder, straightening his tie, grabbing his lapel, hugging him if he agreed to the proposition being made. If he dropped down into his own front row center chair, he might sprawl down in it, stretch out both long legs across the aisle, or lean far back, crossing them, but he wouldn't stay in any pose long. Jiggling, scratching, crossing and uncrossing his legs, leaning back in his chair with a hand up to his face as he whispered to Russell close behind him or to a senator who had approached with information or an inquiry, pulling out a tally sheet, writing something on it, tucking it back in his pocket. He seemed, in the words of one reporter, simply unable to sit still for a moment. Abruptly, galvanized by a sudden thought, he would leap out of his seat, going from slouched to almost frenetic in an instant, as another reporter put it, to rush over to a senator. You'd see him with the finger right in the face. He'd be over on the Republican side as much as the Democratic. Then he'd be back across the floor, pulling someone else off to the side, a slash of vivid movement through the senatorial still life. And if something was going wrong, Lyndon Johnson would be moving even faster, moving so fast that, Neil McNeil reported, his baggy-cut, almost zoot suit flies open. Once, when Johnson was away from the floor, a number of senators unexpectedly began proposing one controversial, contradictory, and often confusing amendment after another to a routine post office appropriation bill being managed by Olin Johnston. The mere discussion of those amendments would plunge the Senate into the kind of angry debate that in past years would have brought it to a halt for endless days, Steele wrote. Passage of any of the amendments would result in a certain Eisenhower veto. The Senate was in a turmoil. The babble on the floor prevented senators from hearing and being heard. There were amendments to amendments, amendments offered and withdrawn. Senators arose to protest they couldn't hear the debate, didn't understand what was transpiring. Then into this mixed-up mess roared Lyndon Johnson. Quickly sizing up the situation, he began to act. He paced from one side of the Senate chamber to the other, moving at a loping gait, the coattails of his gray flannel suit winging out behind. He whispered with Bill Noland, with Frank Carlson, the administration spokesman on postal matters. He conferred with Olin Johnston and Johnston's aide. He talked with Russell Long, Ev Dirksen, parliamentarian Charlie Watkins, with Dick Russell. He slipped to a phone, one equipped with a baffled mouthpiece, in an alcove just off the Senate rostrum. He snapped his thumb and second finger with the retort of a firecracker to summon a page for water. The Senate Majority Leader was ready to straighten things out. It would take some straightening out, 7 different maneuvers. Johnson was running the whole show. From his Majority Leader's desk, he hand-signaled the various players in the drama. He peremptorily cut senators off to seize the floor. He barked harsh orders to Jack Kennedy in the presiding officer's chair to put this question, make that ruling. He pleaded with senators to defer speeches. He whispered to aides to summon this or that senator. He snapped his fingers like a whip to fetch more water. He sped to the cloakroom for a conference and back to his desk. He ranged the aisles. A legislative catastrophe was averted. And that was on a non-controversial, relatively minor bill. On a vote on which the vote was going to be close, and the result of genuine political significance, the frenzy of Lyndon Johnson's actions escalated another notch. As the moment approached for the roll call, the call that would determine the actual irrevocable winning or losing for this man who had to win, Lyndon Johnson's orders grew sharper, more punctuated with fury. Some of his votes, votes he had counted on, were missing. There was no more, "Sure, I understand, I hope he feels better." "By God, I got to have his vote," he rasped to Hennings's assistant, Bernard Fensterwald. "Get him in here." To other senators' aides, there was a single sentence delivered in a low, threatening snarl. "Get your fucking senator over here." Once in the well, he dispatched Baker to the cloakroom to make a call. Bobby, walking away from him, didn't move fast enough. With one long step, Lyndon Johnson caught up to him, grabbed each of Baker's narrow shoulders in a huge hand, and shoved him violently up the aisle. Once, Humphrey told a reporter, Johnson, after ordering him to do something and to get going, was so impatient that he actually kicked him, hard, in the shins to speed him on his way. The reporter, Robert S. Allen, thought Humphrey must be exaggerating until he, Humphrey, added, "Look," and he pulled up his trouser leg, and sure enough, he had some scars there. He had a couple of scars on his shins where Lyndon had kicked him and said, "Get going now." Some of the senators he needed on his side were still planning to vote the other way. On one vote, the recalcitrants included John Pastor. Talking to the little Rhode Islander, Johnson led him into the cloakroom where they could not be seen from the galleries. Then he took each of Pastor's lapels in a hand, pulled the hands together, and lifted them up so that Pastor was held motionless on tiptoe while Johnson brought his face down to stare into his eyes and deliver the argument that way. The leader was hurrying back and forth across the chamber, prowling the aisles, charging up the stairs to the cloakroom, and then, suddenly, the moment was at hand, the moment for which he had been waiting. The number of votes on the tally sheet in his hand was, at last, the number he needed. He would win, if nothing changed. If the senator in the chair was not a thoroughly loyal Johnson man, he quickly put someone in the chair who was. And, prompting him across the well, he hurried the new presiding officer through his paces. Standing next to his leader's desk, he would mutter along, "No further amendments, third reading of the bill, the clerk will call the roll." There might be interruptions from the floor, from opponents. The muttering would become a growl, sometimes audible in the gallery. "Out of order," Lyndon Johnson would prompt. "Out of order." "Out of order," the senator in the chair would say. "Call the question," Lyndon Johnson would prompt. "Call the question." The question would be called. "Yeas and nays have been ordered. The clerk will call the roll." And with those last words, the words that signaled the actual vote, the power of Lyndon Johnson as majority leader was fully revealed. For during the 6 years of his leadership, the Senate of the United States presented, during close and crucial votes, a spectacle such as had never been seen before during the century and a half of its existence. If all his senators were present when the roll call began, and he could see that there were absentees on the other side, he wanted the roll to be called at a fast pace. If he didn't have all his men there, if some stragglers hadn't been found yet, then he wanted the roll call to be slow. And during the years when he was the leader, the roll was called at precisely the pace he desired. Standing at his front row center desk, facing the presiding officer and clerk calling the roll, Lyndon Johnson would raise his big right hand, and with a pen or pencil, or simply with a long forefinger, would make those revving up circles in the air that meant, as was said in the introduction, hurry up, he had the votes and wanted them recorded, before something changed. When, however, he didn't have the votes, but would get them if only he had a little more time, he would make the downward pushing motion with his open hands that meant slow down. As senators hurried into the chamber, many walked down to the well to talk with their colleagues. Standing at the edge of the well, towering over men in it, Lyndon Johnson would raise his long arm over them, making those big circles, like an orchestra conductor leading the United States Senate, the Senate that, for so long, had refused to be led. Sometimes he would indulge in an even more blatant manifestation of his power. Somehow the vote hadn't worked out as he had thought it would. He was a vote or two short of victory. So a vote or two would be changed, right out in the open. Johnson would walk across the floor to a senator who had been in opposition and whisper to him, and the senator would rise and signal the clerk that he had been incorrectly recorded. You would see votes changed right in front of your eyes, the Senate aide says. Neil McNeil, who knew the Senate so well, could hardly believe what he was seeing. He did it in front of God, McNeil was to recall. It didn't happen much, but it happened. He was absolutely brazen about it. He put the arm on guys right on the floor. Sometimes Johnson would not even bother to walk across the floor. Once he yelled across the floor to Freer, who was sitting at his desk, "Change your vote, Allen!" The senator from Delaware did not immediately respond, so Johnson yelled again, in a shout heard, in the words of one writer, by more than 80 senators and the galleries, "Change your vote, Allen!" Allen changed his vote. Small wonder that Hugh Seide, remembering years later the tall man with his mind attuned to every sight and sound and parliamentary nuance, who signaled the roll calls faster or slower, who gave another signal and the door would open and two more guys would run in, would say, "My God, running the world, power enveloped him." Some of the touches that Johnson brought to the role of leader were merely for dramatic effect. Often these shows were carefully orchestrated and perhaps even a shade melodramatic, Bobby Baker was to recall. He, Johnson, was not only a fine actor but a fine director and producer as well. He delighted in striding about the Senate floor, conferring and frowning and giving the impression of great anxiety, while the packed press gallery and the visitors' galleries buzzed and hummed with tensions, even though he knew, and I was one of the few people who knew, that he had three decisive votes hidden in some capital nook, and would produce them at the most effective moment. The Republicans would snort at losing another cliffhanger, the newspapers would trumpet a new Johnson miracle, and Lyndon Johnson would go off to a fresh Cutty Sark and soda to laugh and laugh. But, Baker was also to say, I see nothing wrong in such trickeries. Lyndon Johnson knew that the illusion of power was almost as important as real power itself, that, simply, the more powerful you appeared to be, the more powerful you became. It was one of the reasons for his great success. Some of the more perceptive journalists realized that some of the drama they were reporting was staged drama. Lyndon Johnson played leader, Seide says. But he played the part well. Played it better, far better, than anyone had ever played it before. Played it as if he was made for it, as if he had been born for the role. And however he got the power, he got it. Doris Kearns Goodwin was not the only writer who was to call Lyndon Johnson the Master of the Senate, because that was what he was. Chapter 26. Zip, Zip. And with this power, Lyndon Johnson made the Senate work. Thanks to his intervention in the standing committees, his coordination of their schedules, and his prodding of their chairman, bills were emerging from committees faster than in the past. And since they were emerging with most points of contention already resolved, on the floor they were being passed faster than in the past. The reciprocal trade bill was one example. For decades, after the Second World War as before it, the bill's arrival on the floor had caused the Senate to grind to a halt, sometimes for weeks, as free trade senators fought protectionists and the protectionists fought among themselves, no fewer than 20 states having products they insisted be protected by tariff, and with the rates of each tariff the subject of separate bargaining. In 1955, the bargaining had, thanks to Johnson, taken place within the Finance Committee, where the log rolling went far more smoothly than it would have done in public. And with the necessary compromises agreed, he had been able to secure a unanimous consent agreement to limit debate. There was still another hurdle, a high one for previous reciprocal trade bills. There was traditionally a roll call on the measure, since there always seemed to be some senators who demanded one, and protectionist senators privately in favor of a bill often voted against it to avoid having to explain an affirmative vote to their constituents. The hurdle was removed for the 1955 bill. Putting a supporter of the bill in the chair, Johnson armed him with a surprise parliamentary tactic. Instead of calling for the yeas and nays whenever there was a show of a few hands requesting one, the presiding officer responded to the request by invoking Article 1, Section 5 of the United States Constitution, which said that yeas and nays should be ordered only at the desire of one-fifth of those present. And Johnson made sure that there were always enough senators present with instructions not to vote for the roll call request, so that the necessary one-fifth was never achieved. The Reciprocal Trade Act of 1955 passed in 3 days. Reciprocal trade was only one example. The Upper Colorado River Reclamation Bill, one of the most vital but controversial measures among Westerners, had been brought up in session after session, hotly and often lengthily debated, but never passed. In 1955, it too passed in 3 days. The Paris Accords, which, as Stuart Alsop wrote, could have been expected at the very least to have elicited a lot of oratory for the folks at home, were passed in less than 2 hours of floor debate. Then there were the dozen departmental appropriation bills, those measures that had been stalling Senate machinery for years, decades, in fact. Traditionally, as Alsop wrote, the agriculture appropriation bill, touching as it does many sensitive farm pocketbooks, is the subject of loud, long, and angry argument. In 1955, it passed all but unnoticed after exactly an hour of debate. The other appropriation measures were handled with comparable dispatch. Even one, the bill covering the Departments of State and Justice that was being handled by an appropriations subcommittee, whose chairman, Harley Kilgore, was one of the few chairmen who had refused to coordinate or even discuss his subcommittee's deliberations with Johnson because he viewed such discussions as an infringement on his independence. Despite Kilgore's secretiveness, Johnson knew exactly what was going on in his subcommittee, and when, near the close of Senate business at the end of one May week, Kilgore suddenly appeared on the floor to announce that his subcommittee had completed its work and had a bill prepared, Johnson was ready. He asked a question to which he already knew the answer. Was the subcommittee report a unanimous report? It was a unanimous report, Kilgore replied. In that case, Johnson said, the bill would be brought up at the earliest possible moment the next week. He had already discussed that schedule with the distinguished minority leader, he said. The distinguished minority leader had agreed. As for routine business, in a single day, as Newsweek reported, the Senate passed 90 bills, confirmed an ambassador and a federal trade commissioner, and then knocked off because it had temporarily run out of business. The elapsed time, 4 hours and 43 minutes. Washington was jolted to attention. The first session of the 84th Congress, Alsop wrote, is certainly the most efficiently run session in recent memory. In less than 6 months as majority leader, the youngest majority leader in its history, Lyndon Johnson had tamed the untamable Senate. Although the Senate was running more efficiently, however, it sometimes seemed to be running in opposite directions. But underlying most of its significant actions was a single principle that determined which legislation would be passed and which wouldn't. The principle was the ambition of its leader. As leader of the majority instead of the minority, Lyndon Johnson's personal interests affected America's interests more directly than ever before. And when they conflicted, his interests came first. Richard Russell had by now made most of the Southern Caucus understand that the way to make the South part of the United States again, to really put an end to the Civil War, would be to elect a Southerner president, and they understood that their beloved Dick, giving up his own dream, had anointed Lyndon as that Southerner. With the unbeatable Eisenhower expected to run again in 1956, victory that year would probably not be possible. But the Democratic nomination might be, and the nominee in 1956 would be a front-runner for the 1960 nomination. And they understood, to those of them slow in grasping the fact Russell had made them understand, that in order for Johnson to attain the nomination, he would first have to be perceived as a strong and successful Senate leader, and that therefore he would have to have a unified party behind him, and they must bend their views to support him and not simply oppose the leader's every attempt to pass even moderately liberal legislation. That they must, in fact, even allow him at times to, in George Reedy's words, engage in maneuvers that would facilitate the passage of legislation with at least a tinge of liberalism, legislation they would never have permitted another leader to pass. This understanding had allowed Johnson, again in Reedy's words, to obtain elbow room from the Southern Democrats in his attempts to establish at least a modicum of rapport with Senate liberals. The Southern dons of the Senate, the conservative men with seniority and power, regarded him with pride as their boy, Booth Mooney says. The Southerners did not always agree with their leader, but they wanted him to do well, and when it was necessary, were usually willing to stretch their own convictions to support him. As Johnson advanced toward a more liberal position, his rear and his flank had therefore been protected against the Southern attacks that would normally have made that advance impossible. There was even a symbol of that protection. The fact that as Lyndon Johnson sat in the Senate, the desks directly to his rear and at his side were manned by Russell and Walter George, the two most important Southerners. Some of the less senior Southerners had even made sacrifices, short-term sacrifices for which they had been assured they would be recompensed in the long term. To help him do well, to help him achieve the unity with liberals he needed, they had agreed that young liberal senators be appointed to committee seats into which they themselves would otherwise have moved through seniority. They had allowed the entrance of Humphrey into high party councils. Some Southerners still couldn't understand how they had been talked into that. Harry Byrd said to Johnson one day, "Lyndon, I'll never understand how in the world you got me to liking Hubert Humphrey so much." And there were more subtle means of assistance. Johnson was no longer placed in the embarrassing position of attending or declining to attend meetings of the Southern Caucus. He simply was no longer invited. On a number of issues, however, Dick Russell and his Dixieland band would alter their position not an inch, and on those issues Lyndon Johnson marched to their tune. On the issue that mattered above all others, the Southerners were, as Strom Thurmond's aide Harry Dent puts it, just as sure as ever that in his heart he was on their side. A confidence that was understandable, since, added to his 18 years of votes on their side and his other actions of support for them in the past, were the actions he was taking now, in 1955, as majority leader. Almost the first major policy issue that confronted Johnson upon his assumption of the leadership was the issue that would make possible progress in civil rights, the long-dreamed-of change in Rule 22. The Senate liberals who had fought for the change in the past hoped that the liberal Democrats elected in November 1954 would provide the reinforcements needed to vote it through at last. "We had a chance for a significant step forward," Paul Douglas was to recall. But Johnson crushed the hope, in part, in the opinion of some observers, by making it clear to the newly elected senators that his offer of choice committee seats was contingent upon their support of the leadership in the Rule 22 fight. Walter White of the NAACP was to blame the defeat on shrewd horse trading over committee memberships, in part by using Hubert Humphrey to sabotage the liberal caucus from within. After listening to Humphrey argue, with his customary eloquence, that the liberals should abandon the devil theory of history, stop thinking of Johnson as the devil, and give him, now that he was equipped with the new powers of the majority leadership, a chance to see what he could do with the South, and to fight for civil rights not through a frontal assault on the rules but through the regular Senate committees, Douglas went along with Humphrey's pleas to shelve the rules change motion. He knew almost at once that we had made a bad mistake, Douglas was to say. There was no change in Johnson's opposition to civil rights and not the slightest softening in the attitude of the South, which, in fact, emboldened by Johnson's success, sharply stiffened its opposition. Humphrey's persuasiveness, Douglas was to say with bitterness, may not have resulted in any gains for blacks, but it resulted in gains for Humphrey. His role in this matter sealed his alliance with Johnson. Douglas was not alone in this opinion. John Steele informed his editors that in the Rule 22 fight, behind Humphrey stood the offstage figure of Lyndon Johnson. Thwarting a new liberal attempt in 1955 to attain another long-sought objective, statehood for Hawaii, was easy for Johnson. But in May came an assault more threatening to those who believed in separation of the races. The black congressman from New York, Adam Clayton Powell, Jr., attached to one of the South's, to one of Richard Russell's, most cherished proposals, the Military Reserve Bill, an amendment to ban racial segregation in reserve units. And the House of Representatives passed it. The bill was before Russell's Armed Services Committee, and there it stayed. For as much as Russell wanted a reserve system adopted, the threat to separation of the races was too grave. The Senate might pass the bill without the amendment, but the bill would then eventually be returned to the House, which might reinstate the amendment. Elated by the success of the maneuver, liberals were planning to attach a similar amendment to the school construction bill. House conservatives had responded by holding that measure in committee. Attacking Powell's military reserve amendment publicly, Lyndon Johnson said, "The issue that is now holding up passage of this crucial measure is one that has been settled in a number of different forms by the courts and by the executive agencies. Congress is no longer a meaningful forum for such debate. I sincerely hope that this issue can now be worked out and that we will not imperil the existence of our nation by raising issues which can have no meaning in terms of results." And Johnson maneuvered privately as well, getting Eisenhower out front on the issue as he had gotten the president out front on the Bricker Amendment. After Johnson urged him to do so, Eisenhower spoke against the practice of attaching anti-segregation amendments to major bills, saying, "If you get an idea of real importance, a substantive subject, and you want to get it enacted, then I believe the Congress and I believe our people should have a right to decide upon that issue by itself, and not be clouding it with amendments that are extraneous." As for the Reserve Bill amendment, Eisenhower said, "It is entirely erroneous to try to get legislation of this character through by tacking it onto something that is so vital to the security of the United States." Neither of the Powell amendments was enacted into law. Another aspect of Johnson's strategy, and its coordination with the strategy of the South, had been dramatized in January, at the conclusion of Eisenhower's State of the Union address. As the president stepped down from the dais, Noland had hurried over to congratulate him, but Johnson had moved faster and had been the first to reach Eisenhower's side, thereby, as Frank Cormier of the Associated Press put it, winning the informal Capitol Hill foot race to congratulate him. During the months since January, the considerations that had motivated Johnson to thus demonstrate his solidarity with the president had only been strengthened. In late spring of 1955, with the economy booming, the Formosa Strait crisis ended. With the world generally at peace, millions of Americans had, in Stephen Ambrose's words, a feeling of near euphoria, and Eisenhower's promise of peace, progress, and prosperity seemed fulfilled. Johnson was more convinced than ever that opposing Ike would be politically unwise. Proposals were made repeatedly by Democratic senators for investigations of questionable administration activities, such as the Dixon-Yates giveaway of hydroelectric power to Southern power companies. The proposals were shunted by the Democratic leader into the Democratic Policy Committee, from which none of them ever emerged. The Senate's Southern barons likewise had strong reasons for not opposing the president, not only because of the similarities in their philosophies, but because of something that Lyndon Johnson and the barons never discussed in public. As the New Republic was to state, "It is difficult to document, yet the deans of the Senate, men like Walter George and Harry Byrd and Richard Russell and John McClellan, showed a profound disinterest in whether or not a Democrat moves into the White House in 1957. These Southern veterans already have their chairmanships and their committee patronage. The administration is forced to clear important bills and appointments with them. No Democratic successor to Mr. Eisenhower could be more deferential to their prerogatives. In fact, a Democratic president might even cause a great deal of discomfort by prodding for more progressive and less moderate domestic legislation." Though these barons were called Democrats, they were unenthusiastic about the leading Democratic presidential contenders, Stevenson, Harriman, and Kefauver, all liberals, and may have preferred another 4 years with the safely moderate Eisenhower in the White House. By cooperating with the president on such issues as the tariff and foreign aid, and by hamstringing investigations that might have embarrassed the administration, Johnson was acting not only in his own interest, but in their interest as well. The cooperation issue was raised publicly in April in a very dramatic setting. Washington's great annual Democratic gathering, the Black Tie Jefferson Jackson Day Dinner, was usually held in a hotel ballroom, but the guest of honor in 1955 was the man whom the Associated Press called the beloved Mr. Sam of legions of Democrats. No ballroom in Washington could accommodate the more than 3,700 Democrats from across the United States, the largest such crowd in history, who were coming to pay tribute to Sam Rayburn, and the dinner had to be moved to Washington's National Guard Armory. Facing the audience above the dais was a gigantic cartoon of Jefferson and Jackson welcoming Rayburn to the Democratic pantheon, and the cartoon was flanked by huge portraits of FDR and of the most famous living Democrat, Harry S. Truman. Following tributes to Rayburn by Eleanor Roosevelt, "My husband counted on him and never found him wanting," and Adlai Stevenson, "He was there when the record was made," and Rayburn's characteristically humble response, "I accept this honor, feeling my inadequacy." Lyndon Johnson, in his speech, repeated the statement he had made so frequently, that Democrats wanted a party of moderation in 1956. But when the 71-year-old Truman spoke, assailing the GOP's cynicism, the most cynical political behavior since the Harding era, in the familiar Truman rhythms, suddenly the audience, chanting, "Give 'em hell, Harry," louder and louder, seemed to remember that the Democratic Party, in leading America out of the Great Depression and in fighting for social justice, had not been the party of moderation at all. And the next morning, in his suite at the Mayflower, the ex-president gave William White an interview in which he made clear that it was not only Republicans who he felt had recently been guilty of cynical political behavior. He did not want to criticize the Eisenhower administration's Formosa policy, Truman said, because "I haven't got a great deal of information on the subject." But, he said, he did want to criticize one aspect of the situation, that, as White put it, the Senate had not adequately debated the subject. Had there been such a debate, the former president observed, he would have felt no anxiety at all over the ultimate decision, whatever it might have been. And Truman made clear, with Trumanesque vividness of phrase, whom he blamed for the lack of debate, and for other aspects of recent Democratic policy as well, "I have got tired a long time ago of some mealy-mouthed senators who kiss Ike on both cheeks," he said. Mr. Truman did not name these senators, White wrote. The implication seemed inescapable, however, that he was far from satisfied with the restrained partisan activity of the present Democratic leadership of the Senate, headed by Lyndon B. Johnson of Texas. Arrangements had been made earlier for Truman to pay a nostalgic visit to his old Senate desk. "My heart has always been at this desk," he said, adding that his 10 years in the Senate had been "the happiest years of my political life," and to be honored by Senate leaders at a luncheon in the Capitol on Monday. Johnson had no choice but to deliver the Senate's formal welcome, written by Reedy. "This is a better Senate because he was part of it. Welcome back, Harry. The latch string is always out when you pass this way." Then he had to stand next to Truman as reporters asked the former president to confirm the quotes White had used, and he did so quite firmly. He had to pose beside Truman at the luncheon, from which several Southern senators were noticeably absent, and ride beside him on the Senate subway as photographers took pictures. Truman seemed in high spirits. Johnson's smile was noticeably wan. Truman had told White that he had only one remaining political purpose in life, to keep the Democratic Party over on the liberal side. And his trip to Washington had at least succeeded in reminding some liberals that that was the side the party was supposed to be on. Reporting that many Democrats were stirred by his, Truman's, fighting speech, partly because they got so little of the same from the party's actual presidential hopefuls, John Steele commented specifically on Johnson's call for a party of moderation. "Some thought this was a strange Democratic doctrine," he said. And following that April weekend, the attitude of liberal journalists underwent an abrupt and dramatic alteration. "Some Democrats feel the party is compromising with principle," Doris Fleeson wrote in May. Her column of June 3rd said, "Southern senators are sensitive to the charge that they are perfectly satisfied to let Eisenhower continue in the White House. The record they make in support of the president proves, however, that they certainly aren't unhappy. and it is under Southern leadership that all investigations of the administration have faltered, and no majority program has been approved. The New Republic had come to realize that, despite the Senate's new efficiency, there was little political gain in the bills it had passed, and because of the dearth of senatorial investigations of the administration, there will be no heavy ammunition for the Democrats' candidate for the White House in 1956. Columnist Roscoe Drummond began referring to Lyndon Johnson as malleable. In Drew Pearson's columns, he was again being called Lion Down Lyndon. If, however, Lyndon Johnson's interests always came first with Lyndon Johnson, there were times when those interests coincided with America's interests. With the highest of America's interests, the great liberal cause, the cause of social justice. And when they did, the cause advanced. In some areas, conservatives and Southerners would not give Johnson elbow room, but in other areas they would. And when Johnson had it, he used it. In June 1955, in a single week, as the attacks on him by Fleeson and other liberal commentators were continuing to escalate, there arrived a moment in domestic legislation comparable to that which had occurred 2 years before with foreign legislation, a moment in which Johnson's ultimate ambition did not conflict with, but instead coincided with, the aspirations of the liberals who had been attacking him. And in that week he accomplished, suddenly and without warning, gains the liberals had not believed possible. He did it on 2 days of that week, Tuesday, June 7th and Wednesday, June 8th, 1955. On that Tuesday, the Senate voted on housing. The conditions in which America's poor and lower-middle-class families were housed had been a national disgrace for decades, and the situation was growing not better but worse, in part because in 1954 the Republican majorities in Congress had brought to a near standstill even the meager low-rent public housing programs then in existence. Witnesses before the Senate Banking and Currency Committee, which had jurisdiction over housing, had testified earlier in 1955 that more than 10 million American families were living in substandard dwellings, that the number was growing by hundreds of thousands of families each year, and that at the current rate of construction by the private real estate industry, the number was going to grow even faster. The Eisenhower administration's 1955 public housing proposal was to fund 70,000 units over 2 years, a mere 35,000 per year. But Banking and Currency was one of the few Senate committees with a strong liberal bloc. And after hearing Philadelphia's mayor, Joseph Clark, testify that his city alone had 70,000 substandard units, the committee reported out a bill authorizing the construction of 540,000 units over 4 years, or 135,000 per year. The very concept of public housing was anathema to Senate conservatives, who regarded it as pure socialism. And it provoked particular opposition from Southern conservatives, because so many of the families that would be helped by this particular form of socialism would be black. Liberal housing bills had been reported to the floor before and had been killed or drastically scaled back there, and conservatives were confident that this one would be scaled back too. The Indiana Neanderthal, Homer Capehart, had introduced an amendment reducing the number of units to the administration's original 35,000 per year figure, and the amendment's passage, George Reedy recalls, was taken for granted. An extremely careful headcount by the real estate lobby, which, as Sam Schaffer put it, exercises genuine power in virtually every congressional district, had concluded that it would pass by a margin of 51 to 37. Capehart's and Nolan's counts were approximately the same, although, trying to be cautious, they were predicting victory by only 8 votes. Johnson reinforced the prevailing feeling. When reporters asked him about the 8-vote prediction, he said, with an air of dejection, that that was about right. His own count, he said, showed that the margin would be 7. Liberals, as Evans and Novak would recall, had no hope at all. Lehman and Douglas were resigned to fighting yet another lonely, futile battle for public housing. And the liberals knew who was to blame. That very weekend, the ADA had again assailed Johnson for affably acquiescing to the Republican assault upon liberalism, and thereby betraying the Democratic Party's traditional claim to be the party of the people. The majority leader, the ADA said, has consistently used the pretext of party unity to avoid action on liberal legislation. But Johnson's pessimism was only a mask, behind which he was preparing a surprise. His opponent's headcounts had, as a matter of course, included all the Senate's 22 Southerners, with the exception of public housing advocates Sparkman, Hill, and Ellender. Sparkman was, in fact, the author of the 540,000-unit bill. And by traditional Senate standards, that count would have been accurate. But in 1955, there was a new non-traditional element. The Southerners' desire to help Johnson look liberal if they could do so without damage to their basic principles or to their popularity with their conservative political constituency. And at the last moment, over the long Memorial Day weekend before the Tuesday vote, Johnson had thought of a way in which they could vote against the Capehart Amendment without such damage. It was true, he told the Southerners, that the amendment cut back on public housing. But, he said, it nonetheless still authorized those 35,000 units per year. A vote for the amendment might be hard to explain to their constituents. It could make them vulnerable to some rabble-rouser back home who would charge them with voting for public housing. Trying to explain that it was a reduced bill, he said, would be like saying, "My daughter is only a little bit pregnant." "Why vote for public housing at all?" Johnson asked them. It wasn't necessary to do so. All they had to do was vote against the Capehart Amendment, and then vote against the overall bill. That way, he pointed out to the Southerners, they could assure their constituents that they had voted against all provisions for public housing. One of the advantages of dealing with the Southern Bloc in those days was that its members knew how to reach complete and binding agreement without any word of their intentions leaking to the outside, George Reedy was to recall. No one, including Homer Capehart or William Noland, had the slightest inkling of what was in store. That very Tuesday morning, Times' John Steele had bumped into the Indianan in a corridor outside the Senate chamber, and had asked if the 8-vote margin was still firm. "It sure was," Capehart said. At that moment, Lyndon Johnson walked by. "Lyndon," Capehart said loudly, with his customary gift for the elegant phrase. "Lyndon, this time I'm going to rub your nose in shit." Johnson's reply, delivered in a rueful tone, was, "Okay, I guess you've got me." The debate, which began at about 1 o'clock that afternoon, was enlivened by a touch of drama. There was no more ardent supporter of public housing, of course, than the one-time pioneering mayor of Minneapolis. But months earlier, Hubert Humphrey had scheduled an important speech in Minnesota for Monday evening, and the earliest he could return to Washington was via a 7:30 Tuesday morning plane scheduled to arrive in the capital at about 2 o'clock. Johnson had promised him to delay the vote until that time, and had obtained Noland and Capehart's agreement on the grounds of collegial courtesy. But now Johnson's staff, checking with National Airport, was told that the flight, delayed by inclement weather in the Midwest, was running more than an hour behind schedule. Otherwise, the debate proceeded along the expected lines. After Sparkman had introduced and explained the Banking Committee's bill, Paul Douglas, who had been fighting for public housing for so many years, stated his position forcefully. "Anyone who walks into any city of any size in this country, away from the central business district, will find in nearly every case a slum. Streets without trees, houses that are many years old and in disrepair, and children growing up in circumstances that are very difficult. Some of those children," Douglas said, "grow up into fine men. All credit to men like that, and all credit to families like that. But," he said, "most children growing up under those conditions swim against the tide." Over and over again, since almost my maiden speech in the Senate, I showed that the death rate in the slums was very much above the average of the community, that the sickness rate, particularly from tuberculosis and other diseases, was very much greater than the average for the whole community. I showed that the fire rate was high, that the crime rate was high, and that the juvenile delinquency rate was high. After all, Paul Douglas said, looking around at the few senators who were on the floor, juvenile delinquency is just a fancy name for kids getting into trouble. And, he said, the slums are expanding. The cities need help. The people for whom we are speaking on the floor of the Senate this afternoon are the low-income people. They are inarticulate. It is difficult for them to voice their needs. We provide aid and assistance to virtually every other group. We provide assistance to private builders, real estate groups, subsidies galore to those who do not need them, but none or little to those who most need assistance. Mr. President, this is the noblest country on earth, but we have two great blots upon us. One is our treatment of the Negro, and the other is the slums in our cities. Mr. President, we all want a nobler country, a better country. One of the things we must do is cut out the cancer of the slums. So I hope, Mr. President, that the Senate will reject the amendment of the senator from Indiana. By about 4 o'clock, all the scheduled speeches had been delivered. Humphrey had still not appeared, and Capehart and Noland were insisting on an immediate vote. Afraid to leave the floor lest a vote be called, Johnson prowled restlessly around the chamber, glancing at his watch, throwing his troops into the breach. Sparkman rose to provide a lengthy overview of the whole history of public housing, embarking on a series of maneuvers. Quorum calls accompanied by the palms-down motion to direct clerks to read the names slowly. A reversal of his previous refusal to allow Prescott Bush to introduce a last-minute amendment that would assist a local Connecticut housing authority, since discussing the amendment would take time. But Capehart couldn't be stalled much longer. Walking back to the cloakroom door, Johnson shouted to a telephone clerk to get National Airport. Not some airline clerk at National Airport, but an air traffic controller in the airport's control tower, on the phone. When the telephone clerk had done so, Johnson, saying, "Mr. President, I must leave the chamber for a few minutes," rushed into the cloakroom and grabbed the phone. "Damn it, I've got a senator up there," Johnson shouted to the controller. "He's 2 hours overdue, and I want him down quick. He's got to vote. You better be awful sure he's not stacked up there." The controller said that Humphrey's plane was indeed stacked up, in a holding pattern over Pittsburgh. A lot of planes were stacked up in the pattern, the controller said. Johnson stopped shouting. His voice grew quiet and threatening. "Well, you better be goddamned sure none of those planes comes in before his comes in," he said. After checking to make sure that a Capitol Police car was waiting at the airport to rush Humphrey to the chamber, he returned to the floor where the debate was droning languidly on. At 5:13 p.m., Humphrey appeared on the floor. A quorum call was in progress. Johnson twirled his index finger, and the names came out faster and faster, and after the call was completed, the vote on the Capehart Amendment began. Capehart was sitting complacently at a front-row desk, without a clue to what was about to happen, until the clerk reached the name of Senator Price Daniel of Texas, a staunch opponent of public housing whose vote, Capehart was sure, would be in favor of his amendment. "Senator Daniel?" the clerk called. "No," Senator Daniel replied. "Capehart's head jerked around so rapidly I was afraid his neck was going to snap," George Reedy recalls. And what he saw was another shock. The last time Capehart had looked around, most of the Democratic desks had been empty. They weren't empty now. Sitting at them were the Southerners who he had been certain would support his amendment. And the shock was intensified by their votes, as Capehart's face showed. For once it was the literal truth to say that a man's jaw dropped as Southerner after Southerner voted against him, Reedy recalls. Not only Daniel, but Ellender, Irvin, Fulbright, George, Gore, Johnston, Kefauver, Kerr Scott, Sparkman, and Stennis, and of course Lyndon Johnson himself, voted no. Russell and Eastland, of whose votes Capehart had also been confident, abstained. Had Johnson needed their votes to defeat the amendment, they would have voted no. Smathers, Long, and McClellan had already been lost to Capehart through pairs. Capehart had expected to get 18 or 19 votes from the Southern Bloc. He got 5. His amendment was defeated, 44 votes to 38. As the vote was announced, ponderous Homer Capehart, who had spent the day predicting his own victory by 8 votes, was a slumped-down hulk, a pale-faced man in a rumpled suit at his Senate desk, John Steele was to report. Bill Noland, his face a fiery red, stared stunned at the telltale tally sheet in front of him. Then came the vote on the overall housing bill. Many of the Southerners voted against that measure also. But while their votes on the amendment had been decisive, on the bill itself their opposition had no significance, so overwhelmingly was the rest of the Senate in favor of the measure. It passed 60-25. As soon as the vote was announced, Reedy recalls, the Southern Democrats hastened to the Senate recording facilities where they had themselves plugged into radio stations all over their home states. There they explained to their constituents that they voted against the Capehart Amendment because it still represented socialism, 35,000 units per year of it. Liberal senators remained on the Senate floor because they had something they wanted to say there. Hubert Humphrey thanked both sides of the aisle for making it possible for me to vote in favor of a progressive and decent housing bill, but said that, most particularly, I desired to express profound thanks to the distinguished majority leader, my friend, the senior senator from Texas. The senator from Texas, Humphrey said, is a genius in the art of the legislative process. And, Humphrey said, his genius was being used in behalf of an effective Democratic Party liberal program. I know, he said, that the purpose of the senator from Texas is to direct Congress so that its legislative behavior is a humanitarian one, consistent with the basic tenets of the New Deal and the Fair Deal. Fulsome praise of Johnson from Humphrey had become routine in the Senate, so that the words of the next speaker were more meaningful. For the next speaker was Paul Douglas. Douglas, who so distrusted Johnson, Douglas, who believed that Johnson's motives were not at all liberal, Douglas, who had been denied his rightful committee assignments by Johnson. I am frank to say I did not think it would be possible to defeat the Capehart Amendment, Paul Douglas said. I do not know the precise methods by which the Capehart Amendment was defeated, but it was due to the extraordinary political virtuosity of the leader of the Democratic Party in the Senate, and I wish to thank and congratulate him. And more meaningful still was the scene in G-14 an hour or so later, where Johnson was holding court. Among those present were the regulars at such celebrations, Humphrey, Bobby Baker, several members of the Southern Bloc, two or three chosen journalists. But also present was a senator who had not been invited to G-14 since Johnson had evicted him from it. Paul Douglas had not wanted to accept Johnson's invitation, but he felt he had to accept it. He had been fighting for so long for decent apartments to help the low-income people, the inarticulate people, to help them swim against the tide, fighting without success. Now, at one stroke, more than 500,000 apartments had been provided, and, being Paul Douglas, he had to give to the man responsible what he knew the man wanted. While Johnson was holding forth, with Baker and Humphrey and the others laughing loudly at his jokes, Paul Douglas kept his distance, standing just inside the door. But when Johnson, gloating over the details of his triumph, looked over at Douglas and said, "Well, Paul, you got what you wanted, didn't you?" Douglas walked over to Johnson's desk, so that he was standing directly in front of him, grave and dignified, as Evans and Novak wrote, and said, "I didn't think you could do it, and I will never know how you did it, but you did it, and I'm grateful." The next day, Wednesday, June 8th, the issue was the minimum wage, which hadn't been increased in 6 years. It was still the same 75 cents per hour it had been in 1949. And neither had the coverage, which liberals had been trying to extend to low-paid employees in the retail and service industries. The Eisenhower administration had proposed a 20% increase to 90 cents per hour, but had declined to broaden coverage. Conservative senators like Spessard Holland opposed even that modest increase. Since the Labor Committee subcommittee handling the matter was chaired by Paul Douglas, it was expected that the bill that would be reported out would both broaden coverage and raise the minimum to $1.25. If it did, the bill would therefore contain two provisions that conservatives would not accept, and the bill would therefore not pass, and there would be no improvement in the financial situation of low-paid Americans. Lyndon Johnson didn't wait until the bill reached the floor, or even until it reached the full Labor Committee. He began working instead on the subcommittee, where he had only 7 senators to persuade, and he convinced them to report out a moderate bill calling for a $1 minimum wage and no broadening of coverage. With liberals determined to hold out for $1.25 and broader coverage, and many conservatives opposed even to the $1 figure, one conservative, Republican H. Alexander Smith of New Jersey, was preparing an amendment that would raise it only to the 90 cents the administration wanted. There were enough liberals and conservatives opposed to the bill so that it appeared that the 1955 minimum wage scenario would follow the scenario of previous years, and that at the end of the day no bill would be passed. The scenario was to be rewritten in 1955, however, thanks to those eyes that missed nothing on the floor. That Wednesday, trying to avoid a floor fight that would not only split the Democrats but dramatize the split to the world, Lyndon Johnson had been working for a compromise, passage of Smith's proposed 90-cent amendment and of the rest of the Labor Committee bill, with its status quo coverage, and had been trying to get enough votes for this strategy by playing on the worst fears of both sides, telling liberals that he had counted votes and if they didn't settle for 90 cents, there would be no increase at all, telling conservatives that he had counted votes and if they didn't settle for 90 cents, they might find the minimum wage increased to $1.25. The cloakroom was just jammed. We knew what he was telling both sides, but there was just enough credibility in it. He was a master, says one Senate aide. And he had apparently succeeded. The Smith Amendment and the rest of the Labor Committee bill was going to pass. And then, all at once, Lyndon Johnson, standing next to his desk as he managed the bill under the unanimous consent agreement he had negotiated, noticed something. Under that agreement, 2 hours had been allocated to discussion of the Smith Amendment. The Republican arguments in favor of it had been completed, but the Democratic hour was just beginning. Not expecting a vote for an hour, senators had begun wandering on and off the floor. All at once, although there were still a substantial number of senators on the floor, that number did not include most of the liberals who opposed the Labor Subcommittee bill, or most of the conservatives who opposed the bill. By coincidence, at that moment, the bill's strongest opponents all happened to be gone at the same time, leaving on the floor mostly moderates who were willing to settle for an unamended bill, no broadening of coverage but an increase to $1 in the wage, in the form the Labor Committee had reported. "I think we'll pass that minimum wage bill now," he told Hubert Humphrey, with whom he had been talking. It happened very quickly. "Mr. President," Johnson said. The presiding officer recognized him. "I yield myself such time as I may require," Johnson said, speaking fast. "The committee considered this question long and thoroughly. I am hopeful that we shall not start amending the bill. I yield back the remainder of my time and ask for a vote." "All time on the amendment has been used or yielded back," the presiding officer said, and called for a vote. It was a voice vote, and the amendment was defeated. Suddenly, the pending matter was the unamended bill itself. "The bill having been read the third time, the question is, shall it pass?" the presiding officer said. No Republicans were waiting to speak, and Noland yielded back his remaining time. "Mr. President," Johnson said, "I yield back the remainder of my time." A voice vote was taken, and the chair announced that the bill was passed. "Zip, zip," Humphrey was to recall. "He called it up, and it passed just like that. Voice vote, zip." Lister Hill, the Labor Committee chairman, was in the cloakroom at the time and did not even know what was happening. Herbert Lehman happened to wander onto the floor as the clerk was announcing that the bill had passed. "What's the vote on?" he asked. Told that it had been on the minimum wage bill, Lehman was speechless. Spessard Holland wasn't. Boy, oh boy, Spessard Holland came charging out of the Senate dining room and he wanted to know what had happened here, Humphrey would recall. Oh, he was just jumping, screaming, hollering, and pounding the desk. Johnson said, "Well, Spessard, I had a little vote. If you fellows aren't on the job around here, I've got legislation to pass." He just slipped it right on through there. Zip. Oh boy, they were furious with him. While both sides were furious, however, the fury of the liberal side was tempered by the realization that not only had an increase in the minimum wage finally been achieved, the increase to a dollar was higher than the 90-cent increase that the administration had proposed. As Reedy was to say, "Obviously we were proceeding on the half-a-loaf theory, but it seems to me that the scoffers must be men and women who have never been hungry." Among those who agreed was old Matthew Neely, whose state of West Virginia was home to tens of thousands of coal miners who had just had their wages increased by a third. Rising stiffly at his desk, Neely said, "This has been a senatorial red-letter day for labor. With a minimum of debate, a maximum of efficiency, and a majestic measure of humanity, we have increased the minimum wage from 75 cents to $1 an hour. This action will cause rejoicing in thousands of American homes." "Some of us had hoped the amount would be somewhat larger," Hubert Humphrey said. "But surely, by this very decisive action in the Senate, we have raised the economic levels of vast numbers of persons." And among those who agreed was Paul Douglas. Passage of the minimum wage bill had confirmed the feelings about Lyndon Johnson that Douglas had expressed the previous day after the passage of the housing bill. "I was against him for leader, but I think I was wrong," he told his administrative assistant, Frank McCullough. I think now he's the best man for the job. The last time a minimum wage bill had been before the Senate, Lyndon Johnson had voted against increasing it. Now he had fought for an increase in the wage, and the wage had been increased. Whatever the reason for his change on that issue, he had changed, and had made the Senate change with him. Whether or not Lyndon Johnson talked about principled things or believed in principled things, and in both the public housing and minimum wage fights he had all but ignored the issues and concentrated on maneuvers, he had won principled things for hundreds of thousands of Americans who needed those things. The slickness of Johnson's maneuver had senators laughing among themselves as they walked out of the chamber, but the liberals had much more reason to laugh. Lyndon Johnson had not only made the Senate work, he had, in at least two areas of social welfare legislation, made it work on behalf of that legislation. For so many decades, generations, the Senate had stood against such legislation like a dam. The dam was being breached now. The talk of political Washington today is the way Lyndon Johnson runs the Senate, Leslie Carpenter wrote in his column on June 12th. And the talk and the print now ranged all across the political spectrum. Conservative Gould Lincoln's The Political Mill ground for him in the Washington Star. Under the headline, Lyndon Moves Mountains, Lincoln wrote that the Senate, which so often has been the stumbling block over which legislation has fallen by the wayside, has set a pace rarely equaled. All this hasn't just happened. There's a tall Texan in the saddle. The Wall Street Journal ordered up a long article on the Texas-sized Texan who runs the smoothest Democratic show in years. Johnson had been enjoying praise from conservatives all year, but now, following the passage of the housing and minimum wage bills, liberals joined them on the Johnson bandwagon. On several occasions in the past, this newspaper has been critical of Senator Johnson's leadership, the Washington Post editorialized. We are happy to say that in this session of Congress he has exhibited a remarkable amount of finesse, understanding, and restraint, and has served the national interest. Declaring that Johnson had snatched victory from defeat with brilliant political technique, Doris Fleeson added, admiring spectators suggested that all that remains is for him to do his next triumphs to music. Drew Pearson praised the deftness of his leadership. A long Newsweek article on June 27th called him the Texan who is jolting Washington. As the Senate prepared to recess for the long 4th of July weekend, moreover, the lionization by the press was about to take a new turn, the turn Lyndon Johnson had been waiting for. The South had begun to throw out its skirmishers for a Johnson presidential candidacy in 1956. The lack of enthusiasm south of the Mason-Dixon line for a second campaign by Adlai Stevenson was more than equaled by the South's distaste for the men Northern liberals were mentioning if Stevenson were not to be the candidate, the New Yorker Harriman or the apostate Kefauver. The man the South wanted was the man the South always wanted, of course. But now Richard Russell withdrew from consideration in terms so unequivocal that they would have been called Shermanesque, had not that adjective been particularly inappropriate. And the conservative columnist Bascom Timmons wrote that Johnson will inherit much of the support which was given Senator Russell last time. Immediately after Russell's withdrawal, a chorus of such support began to issue from the Southern Citadel on Capitol Hill. Taking the Senate floor on June 30th with the Newsweek article in his hand, Harry Byrd himself read into the record the magazine's prediction that Lyndon Johnson would be president one day. And over the 4th of July weekend, the press was going to join in the chorus, as Johnson knew. George Smathers had given him an advance copy of a front-page editorial scheduled to appear in Florida's Orlando Sentinel on Saturday, July 2nd, an editorial that would say that only the nomination of Lyndon Johnson could put solidarity back in the once solid South and save the Democratic Party from another defeat, that only his nomination can extirpate and expiate the shameful and disgraceful insults heaped upon the South at the last convention. He is the one man who can win back such states as Florida, Tennessee, and Texas. The Stevenson, Kefauver, Harriman liberals are through. They bear the stamp and stigma of the left-wingers and big-city political machines. Johnson had also seen the advance text of a Liz Carpenter article that was going to appear on July 3rd. This supersensitive political town began speculating this week about the first rumblings of a Johnson presidential bandwagon, the article said. The New Republic's July 4th issue would carry what would be described as an exuberant panegyric of Johnson by Senator Richard Neuberger. And most significantly, Robert Albright's Gallery Glimpses column, scheduled to appear in Sunday's Washington Post, which would, as Evans and Novak put it, be on every Sunday breakfast table in the Capitol, contained the words that Johnson so much wanted to read. Lyndon Johnson last week emerged as something more than a highly skilled legislative technician. Unless bystanders missed their guess, he was riding a presidential boom. Having obtained an advance look at the Albright column, Johnson was telling colleagues to be sure to read it Sunday. But Lyndon Johnson himself was not to read those articles on Sunday. On Sunday, July 3, 1955, he lay, as his father had once lain, under an oxygen tent in a hospital, having heard a doctor say to him what a doctor had said to his father, the words he had always dreaded hearing. Chapter 27. Go Ahead with the Blue. As the pace of the 1955 session had accelerated, and with the increased press and public focus on Lyndon Johnson's role as leader, the stakes had grown larger, and with each success, the expectations for further successes and the danger of resultant disappointment and criticism had become greater. The frantic quality to Johnson's efforts had intensified. His days grew longer. His alarm was set for 7:30 a.m., but he was almost always awake when it went off. It wasn't an alarm that was jerking Lyndon Johnson out of sleep. Often the long black limousine would be pulling away from 30th Place by 8 o'clock, with Johnson in the back seat dictating to Mary Rather and leafing through the morning newspapers at the same time. And no matter how early he arrived in 2:31, the morning was never long enough for all the private meetings that senators had requested, for all the telephone calls that had to be made or answered. Every time Walter Jenkins appeared in the doorway of the inner office, more pages of the yellow legal pad he held in his hand would be filled with urgent requests for a moment of the leader's time. There were committee meetings at which he had to put in appearances. Afternoons were spent in the unremitting tension of the chamber and the cloakroom, every minute seemingly filled with a task that couldn't be postponed. Lunch would often be a hamburger, placed on his office desk by Mary or Ashton as he was talking to someone in person or on the telephone. He would gobble a bite or two, put it down, resume talking. Sometime later, cold now, the rest of the hamburger might be eaten, or it might not. Or Jenkins would bring a hamburger to the cloakroom and hand it to him, and as he talked, Johnson would absent-mindedly put it down on the little desk along the wall. An hour or two later, the leader's hamburger would still be sitting there. One day, Johnson ordered his staff to set aside an hour for a late lunch at the conference table in his private office with Arthur Kroc. The Times columnist was very important to him, but as he was leaving the Senate floor, a matter unexpectedly arose that required him to stay to resolve it, and he arrived a half hour late. He had instructed Jenkins that he was not to be interrupted except for calls that simply could not wait. During the lunch, there were 8 such calls, 3 of them on matters sufficiently complicated so that, as Kroc put it, it was essential to talk at length. Johnson would return to the table, resume talking to Kroc. Suddenly he would remember something he had forgotten to say, some instruction he had forgotten to give, some instruction he had given that might be misunderstood without further explanation. In the middle of a sentence or a bite, he would jump up, grab the phone, make sure everything was clear, every base covered. And then Jenkins was buzzing in to say that the important delegation he had agreed to see had already been waiting in the outer office for some time, and the lunch had to be ended, half the meal uneaten. Trying to cram everything in, he would run from place to place. More than once I saw him literally run the few steps from a doorway in the Senate office building to his car waiting at the curb, Ashton Ganella would recall. As he was managing a Senate debate, the car would be waiting outside in the portico beneath the Senate steps, and his driver, Norman Edwards, would often have the motor running, for there was no time. For a 3:30 plane, he left at 3:30, with Ashton or Mary Margaret Wiley or Jenkins on the phone to the airport to ask them to hold the flight until he got there. Senator Johnson is on his way. When the Senate recessed at 6 p.m. or later, it was across the Capitol, often at a dog trot, to the Board of Education, then back to G14, to put on the day's events the spin he wanted for the voracious journalists waiting there. And before he went home, there would be the next day's session to arrange. It has become almost a commonplace for friends to receive telephone calls from him as late as 10 o'clock at night and to find that he was still at his Capitol office, Robert Albright was to write. One evening in June, he didn't arrive home until after midnight. So ashen was he with fatigue that Lady Bird took one look at him, told him to get into bed, and brought dinner to him on a tray. And the nights were not for sleeping. In Walter Jenkins's recollection, there was hardly one now during which his telephone did not ring at least once. And in other houses in quiet Washington neighborhoods, too, in the homes of senators as well as staffers, a phone would ring in the early morning darkness, and a man, jolted out of sleep, would reach groggily out for the phone to hear the leader's voice on the line. The antidotes with which he tried to relieve the tension he took with a frenzied compulsiveness. His secretaries were still mixing his drinks weak, but, coming back to G14 after the Senate recessed for the day, sinking into the big chair and having a glass placed in his hand, he would throw back his head, empty the glass in a single gulp, immediately hold it out and rattle the ice cubes for another Cutty Sark and soda, and another, and another. More and more, the man who wanted never to be out of control because of drinking was out of control. Nicotine was, as always, the antidote he relied on most. His fingers were stained yellow with it. No matter how often Ashton and Mary Margaret emptied the ashtrays in his office, they were soon filled again. There was a feverish impatience in the way in which, in the middle of a tense conversation, he would reach for the open pack on his desk, pull out a cigarette, and fumble to light it. Sometimes, sitting in one of the soft armchairs in the cloakroom, he would light a fresh cigarette and bend low over it, inhaling deeply as he took the first long drag. Smoking was not allowed in the Senate chamber. If Johnson had to be present but didn't have to be at his desk, he would stand in the rear of the chamber, just in front of the cloakroom doors, with his hand cupped around a hidden cigarette. He was too wound up to stop talking, and at dinner parties at which the drinks were not mixed weak, all inhibition was gone. Russell Baker was to describe him at one party. Four or five tables, guests of the Dean Acheson and Abe Fortas caliber. In the garden of William White's home, chain-smoking one cigarette on top of another and pouring down Scotch whiskey like a man who had a date with a firing squad. During the drinking hour before dinner, I watched him taking in rivers of smoke and whiskey and waving his hands and weaving his long, skinny torso this way and that, all the while talking non-stop to a group of four or five who seemed enthralled by the performance. Baker, who had recently returned from a stint with the Baltimore Sun's London Bureau, was seated next to Johnson at dinner.
End of Disc 26.